My name's Glenn Homburg, and it's great to see you here. I'm going to interview Lewis, and then we'll get underway. So Lewis, just tell us what an astrophysicist is, because we plugged you as a former astrophysicist.
Right.
What's an astrophysicist?
It's pretty simple. It's just applying the regular old sort of laws of physics that you do with nuclear physics or quantum physics or something to things outside of the Earth, pretty much. So other planets, other stars, other galaxies, nebulae, and so on. So it's just physics applied to other kinds of objects out there.
I don't know if that helps. And you were looking at, you did a PhD in particles that are not quite, no?
Well...
Or was it your postdoctorate?
That was just kind of along the way. I did a little bit of neutrino stuff, but okay. Mostly it was something else.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. So, along the way, I guess the thing that I know about his research was you can't look inside a burning sun. You can't see the reactions going on inside, but out of the sun, it spits things called neutrinos. And you can study them to try and work out what's going on inside, you know, the nuclear reaction of the sun. So that's what Lewis was doing. He now works, I guess you might call him a chaplain to university academics. So he works on university campuses, speaking to people who are the lecturers and tutors on university campuses around Australia. Now, Lewis, why are you passionate about science? I mean, you did a PhD in science. I know you left science, but at one point it must have been a passion. You know, what's good about science? Why do you like it?
Well, I think one of the great things about science, and the thing that makes it exciting, is that we know so little about the world around us. And so every day I could go to work and I could look at something on some object out there in the wherever, in some other galaxy somewhere, that no one had ever seen before, because that's just what you did. I mean, there is so much we don't know and there's so much we haven't seen that every day was just some new discovery. And it's just fantastic. It's great kind of work.
So that wasn't intimidating? That wasn't kind of... Yeah, I mean, some people would say, oh, there's so much we don't know, let's give up.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think human beings... We're wired for curiosity, so it just drives us on, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you're going to talk about whether there's any limits on science. You're going to refer to a part, one part of his talk is going to refer to a song by the Birds. You might know it. I'm going to read that out now. It's actually from the Old Testament. It's going to get referred to, so I'm just going to read out a bit of that right now. Where are we? What page are we?
Okay. Year to 13.
So this is from an Old Testament book called Ecclesiastes, where a philosopher in the ancient world is just trying to think about the way the world works. And he says this, there is for everything, there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. There's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, time to go cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear, a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain is the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into men's hearts. Yet, so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to the end. I perceive that there's nothing better for them, that is men and women, than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil, for this is God's gift to men. Well, how about a warm round of applause to welcome our speaker officially. And I'll hand over to you. Yeah, you can not use a microphone, but we might just do a sound check.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can just talk like this, and how's that for back there? I feel fine talking like the poor people in the front row are going to get an earful. Is
that all right? I reckon use the microphone.
Okay, I'll use the microphone. All right. This means in my hands I can't do this. Okay.
Put the microphone down.
we'll see how we go. We'll see how we go. All right. Well, thanks. It's great to be here, and what we're going to do is we are going to talk not in a general sense about are there limits on science, but actually about one particular limit on science. I think it probably just goes without saying that there are limits of some description on everything that we do. And so I'm not going to try to make a big case about whether there are or are not limits on science, but I just want to talk about one particular limit on science, and it's in relation to our sort of moral reasoning or ethics, okay? So I want to talk about the relationship between science and ethics, not so much, you know, is stem cell research ethical, right? It's not answering those kind of questions. I want to talk about the relationship between this endeavor of science and the relation and the endeavor of ethics or moral thinking, moral reasoning. Okay, that's where we're heading. So a couple of things. We're going to talk about some scientists who are talking about purpose, and I'll introduce the idea of purpose and why that matters in just a minute. The structure of Christian ethics, this is all going to be very quick, all right? Very quick, because I do want you guys to have time for questions in the end as well. The limits of science, on this one particular point. Then finally, this very simple answer to the relationship between science and ethics. And then we'll talk about a few implications. I might not get through all the ones that I've got written down here, but you can ask about them if you like. Okay, so scientists on purpose, first of all, why purpose? Why am I talking about purpose? We're talking about science and ethics. But as we'll see, and I'll develop this a little bit more, but as we'll see, that purpose in the world is what gives us a framework for ethics. So the purpose for which something was created is the measure, in a sense, against which we decide what is right and wrong to do with that object or another person or something. So this pen was probably made for the purpose of writing. Now, it has lots of different functions it can serve. You can jam it under a door and sort of use it for a doorstop, or I can poke Glenn in the eye with it and cause some serious damage. There's all sorts of things you can do with this pen. I don't know if you guys are MASH fans, but I once saw an episode of MASH where Radar and Father Mulcahy are driving this injured soldier back from the front or something to the MASH unit, and along the way, a bomb hits nearby, and a piece of shrapnel gets lodged in said injured soldier's trachea, and so they have to take a ballpoint pen and perform a tracheotomy with the ballpoint pen. Right? So there are nearly infinite number of functions that a pen can have, but in terms of the purpose for which it was created, it has this kind of one purpose, that is to write. And so if you were measuring the kind of morality of the pen, you'd say a good thing to do, the right thing to do with the pen, is to write with it, whereas the evil thing to do with the pen, is to use it for a tracheotomy. Not exactly, of course, because there is no kind of absolute morality for a pen, but you get something of an example there. So purpose is essential when we're thinking about ethics, because purpose sets the stage. It's the measure against which we can the standard against which we can measure the kind of right and wrong, what to do with something. So yeah, that's why we're going to start with a little bit of purpose here. So here's George Porter. He's a Nobel Prize winning chemist. And he says this, this is back from 1975. Most of our anxieties, problems, and unhappiness stem from a lack of purpose, which was rare a century ago, and which can fairly be blamed on the consequences of scientific inquiry. There is one great purpose for man and for us today, and that is to try to discover man's purpose by every means in our power. That is the ultimate relevance of science. So science has actually stripped people of purpose, taken away our purpose, but ultimately the relevance of science is to try and give us back our purpose, to find our purpose, discover man's purpose. So is that what science is about? And is that this relationship of science and purpose? Well, later on, about 8 years later, this fellow Paul Davies, who's another eminent physicist still living today, says this: science has actually advanced to the point. So he's kind of saying, well, we've actually gotten there with science. Science has actually advanced to the point where what were formerly religious questions can be seriously tackled. Or science offers a surer path to God than religion. It's only in recent years, I think it's on your sheet, that scientists have exercised any sort of influence over what might be called the big question. So science has gotten there with this kind of idea of big questions and purpose. Oh, that was terrible. Anyway, that quote is in your outline, if you can take a look there. If you can't read it on the screen. Later on, a fellow named Peter Medawar, who was another Nobel Prize-winning scientist, said this about science and purpose. So he disagrees with the kind of George Porter sort of, we're going to find purpose in science. He says that there is indeed a limit upon science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advances of science would empower it to answer. These are the questions children ask. How did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? Okay, those kinds of questions. So he says, yes, there are limits on science, and purpose is one of those limits. Now, another perspective on this, so we've got the science will discover sort of purpose kind of thing. We've got Peter Medawar saying, no, science is limited in being unable to talk about purpose. Richard Dawkins has yet another perspective on this. He says, before Darwin, even educated people who had abandoned the why question for rocks, that is the purpose question, for rocks, streams, and eclipses, still implicitly accepted the legitimacy of the why question where living creatures were concerned. Now only the scientifically illiterate do. So only scientifically illiterate people think there is purpose in the world. All right? So unfortunately, I think he's probably talking about you and me and everyone else in the room. Okay? But only, he says, conceals the unpalatable truth that we are still talking about an absolute majority of the world's population. Okay, that's us. Now, the fact is that most scientists disagree with Richard Dawkins, and in fact, some very eminent scientists disagree with Richard Dawkins. So for instance, Stephen Hawking talks about discovering a theory of everything. If we do discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone. Hey, that's us, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, this is good, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of why it is that we in the universe exist. Stephen Hawking thinks that the question of why is important. Purpose is still there. There's still something to be found out about purpose, despite what Richard Dawkins says. The Astronomer Royal of the UK, the kind of one of the chief ranking scientists in the UK, Martin Rees, writes this about the kind of fine tuning of the universe. He's an atheist. He says, is this tuning just a brute fact or a coincidence? Or is it the providence of a benign creator? I take the view that it is neither, an infinity of other universes and so on. The point is that he writes books about the fine-tuning of the universe because he feels like the universe requires a response. There's this question of why are things the way they are? And so he even though he's an atheist, he is trying to answer that question. So these illiterate, scientifically illiterate people include people like the Astronomer Royal of the UK and Stephen Hawking and so on. So people do disagree with Richard Dawkins. Now, the big question that we want to come to then is how God made the world related to how one should act in the world? Okay, so that's a tricky sort of question, but that's the question I want to try to answer. How is how God made the world, kind of the nature of things that we find in the world, how is that related to how one should act in the world, our ethics, our moral thinking, okay? And so this relationship between science and ethics, or science and purpose, is can be seen or better understood as the relationship between the nature of things and the rightness of action. So that's what this question is trying to get at. The nature of things, the how of how creation was made, and the rightness of action, how we should act in the world. So what is that relationship? Now, we'll get down then to a little bit of a structure of Christian ethics. And basically, in the Bible, the idea of wisdom is not just a knowledge category, a fact category, but it's a moral category. And so you have this phrase, it's repeated in different places throughout the scriptures. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, that's kind of a coded way of saying what I want to say about the structure of Christian ethics. Now, let me just unpack that a little bit. So first of all, we have two big words today as well. We have generic order and telic order. But you don't have to remember them. You can remember the substitutes that I'll tell you. God is created with generic order. That is patterns in the world. Okay. So these are just the ethical, like the ethicist terms for these things. Okay. But God is created with patterns, rules, regularities in the world. Okay, that's the first point we need to get under our belts. The second point is that God has created with telic order, that is purpose. Telos is just the goal of things. Okay, things have a purpose. Things in this world have a purpose. God has created with the idea of purpose. purpose, teleporter, cannot be read off of the patterns or generic order of the world. That is, you can't determine the purpose of things from the way that they work, right? The pen can be used for lots of different things. You can't tell that this pen was made for writing just by looking at it. You can guess, but you can never be sure, can you? I mean, because you can use it for tracheotomies. And the last thing is the creator is the sole proprietor, the only one who can tell us about this purpose, this idea of purpose in the world. Okay, so whatever has been created with a purpose, and the creator is the one who knows that purpose. The person who made the pen knows what it was made for. Okay, and that person can then tell other people. All right, so those are the 4 points I want to unpack just a little bit. Now, God created with patterns or order or regularity in the world. And you think of Genesis 1. Where everything is made according to its kind, you know, an apple seed is planted in the ground and up grows an apple tree. There's order and pattern and regularities in the world. It's something that's not really at issue so much. The book of Proverbs, right, and just in general the kind of wisdom type literature in the Bible, but the book of Proverbs in the Bible, for instance, and I'll give an example of this, gives generic observations about the world, the way the world works, things that work in the world, in human relationships, things work about the way we do our work, and so on. Ecclesiastes is the same sort of way. But here's just an example from the book of Proverbs. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Now, there's nothing about God there, right? The point is that's just the way the world functions, right? We know that that's generally a truth about the world. Okay? Gentle answer turns away wrath, harsh word stirs up anger. So there's this generic or kind of regularity in the world that God's created. Now, then there's also purpose. God creates things with purpose as well. So again, back to Genesis 1. What you find in Genesis 1 is that God is busy giving purpose to things. So the lights in the sky, the sun, moon, stars, they're there to kind of manage the time, the seasons and the years, the months, the days, and so on. All right. Also, the green plants are given for food. There's a purpose for the green plants. Humanity is given the purpose of ruling over creation, managing it in God's under God's rule and in God's kind of place, in God's stead. So there's purpose given in creation as well, not just the regularities, but patterns as well. And again, there are other lots of examples which we won't go into today. But here's an example of where in Proverbs where purpose kind of comes out, and I'll refer back to what Glenn read earlier from Ecclesiastes 3 at this point. But read this. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself. Next verse, answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. Well, which are you supposed to do? What's going on? So it's two observations about the way the world works, but they're telling you to do two different things. Well, I think the answer to that is in Ecclesiastes 3. There is a time for everything. There is a season for everything under heaven. And part of the purpose that God has with which God has created the world is understanding the times. Our times that we live in, the days of our lives, have purpose. And we need to understand the timing of our lives and the timing of God's plans and purposes to work out which one of these verses we need to apply in any given situation. We can see that there's purpose in everything. That's what Ecclesiastes 3 tells us that again. God has set eternity, this kind of long-term thinking about the purpose, where we're heading in life, eternity in our hearts, and yet we cannot fathom what God has done. So God's created with this purpose, and in the timing of life is one of those areas where we have to try and recognize purpose. But then generic order cannot be read from teleport. That's I got that backwards. Purpose, teleporter cannot be read from generic order, from patterns. Okay? That is, again, you know, the pen, you can't simply work out what the pen was made for by looking at it. Now, you can see this in another thing that Richard Dawkins has said. And in fact, he says this in lots and lots of different ways in different places. But this is helpful coming from Richard Dawkins as a scientist. He says, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt and other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. You see, looking out at the world without God in the frame, that is what you see, isn't it? You see, that's what Richard Dawkins is saying. That's what you get from the world when you look at it without God in the frame. You get a world with no evil, no good, right? So none of that morality that we're wanting to talk about. No purpose, no design, no nothing. Okay? So without God revealing purpose, there is not going to be any certainty about your observed purpose in the world. Hymn writer William Cowper says it like this: blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. That is, it relies on God to reveal to us the purpose in creation. So the relationship then between nature and purpose, the nature of things, the purpose of things, then is what we need kind of must know about how an object works, that's its nature, in order to be able to rightly help it achieve the end for which it was made. Okay, so it's a particular understanding of ethics called teleological ethics. But right action in the world, proper morality, is based on working toward fulfilling the purpose for which things were created. Aristotle used the illustration of an acorn and an oak tree. The purpose, the goal of an acorn is to become an oak tree. And so to do the right thing by the acorn, you know, is to plant it the right depth in the ground and to water it enough and so on, so that you encourage it to achieve the purpose for which it was created. Okay, that's a similar understanding of this goal-focused sort of ethics. So right action is based on trying to fulfill the purpose for which something was created. But we need not only the purpose for that, but we need the nature, how things work. We need to know how things work for that, for us to help that. We need to know how far to bury the acorn in the ground, how much water it needs, what temperature it needs to be at, in order to help it achieve its goal. We don't just need to know the goal for which it was created. We actually need to know how it works in order to help it achieve that goal. And so, back to our big question: how God made the world related to how one should act in the world? What's the relationship between the nature of things and the ethics, the morality of things? And the big answer is, I'll give you the complicated big answer here, and then we'll get to a little bit better answer here in just a second. The confusing, complicated answer is this: morality is man's participation in the created order. Okay, you can take that one away. It's a great little phrase, and if you ever understand what it means, then you'll even be better off. Okay, you can impress your friends with that. Morality is man's participation in the created order. That is, the created order has these patterns built in. It has the nature of things built in. It also has the purpose built in. And so as we participate in it, that is how we live out our morality in the world. But we need to know the purpose behind things to get there. Now, before we give our final answer to the relationship between science and ethics, and try to bring all these kind of ideas together, we want to just hammer home this point about the limits of science in regards to this. Now, you've got this quote in your outline, so you don't need to worry about it on the screen since it's cut off. But this is from John Lennox. We can plug his book over there, from God's Undertaker. And he says this: let us imagine that my Aunt Matilda has baked a beautiful cake and we take it along to be analyzed by a group of the world's top scientists. When these experts have given us an exhaustive description of the cake, can we say that the cake is completely explained? We have certainly been given a description of how the cake was made and how its constituent elements relate to each other, you know, the physics, the chemistry, and so on of the cake. But suppose I now ask the assembled group of experts a final question: why was the cake made? The grin on Aunt Matilda's face shows she knows the answer, for she made the cake, and she made it for a purpose. In fact, the only way we shall ever get an answer is if Aunt Matilda reveals it to us, But if she does not disclose the answer to us, the plain fact is that no amount of scientific analysis will enlighten us. You see? That we cannot, through scientific investigation of the world, work out the purpose of things. Aunt Matilda knows why the cake was made. We can guess, right? It's for some kind of celebration, maybe for a birthday party, maybe for an anniversary, sure. We can speculate on purpose, just like you can with the pen. But you can never be sure what the purpose is unless the creator, the maker of the cake, actually tells you what the purpose is. You can never be sure. So science is limited in that regardless of how much it can say about the patterns and regularities of the creation, it must remain silent on this question of purpose. Okay, so here's the final conclusion about the relationship between science and ethics from all of the drawing these strands together. And this is it. That science provides us with knowledge pertaining to, one of our fancy words for today, generic order, the patterns and regularities of the world. All right? That's what science provides us with. The creator of what we have around us here provides us with the purpose for which things were made. And for us to understand how to act in the world, our ethics, our moral reasoning, we actually require knowledge of both of those things to get our decision-making correct. All right? So science provides us with the understanding of the nature of things, the patterns and regularities of the world, the materials out of which things have been made, and so on. The creator provides us with the purpose for which things were made, and we need both to get down to the business of making right decisions about how to live in the world. All right, well, let's talk about a couple of implications. Scientists are moral agents, but science is not. That is, science, again, it doesn't come, science as an endeavor, as a body of knowledge, does not make ethical comment. I mean, scientists can. Of course, individual scientists are human beings who can have opinions on all sorts of things and make comments on all sorts of things. But science is limited in its contribution, in this sense, to moral reasoning. The contribution that science makes to its to moral reasoning for the kind of public discussion of ethics and morality is that it can tell us how things work. It can tell us the consequences for our actions. You see, we can make predictions about if we take this action, this consequence will follow. If we take that action, that this consequence will follow. And that's really, really helpful. In fact, it's not just helpful; it's essential for working out how to act rightly, to live rightly in the world. But it doesn't tell you which option to take. It cannot tell you which option to take. Science as a thing, as an endeavor, as a human endeavor, cannot tell you which option to take. So consider this statement, for instance. Research is showing that the rise in global temperatures is causing the Antarctic ice to melt. Therefore, we ought to stop the rise in global temperatures. Okay. Now, the first half of that statement is potentially, let's assume that it is for a statement of science. The rise in global temperatures is causing the Antarctic ice to melt. But the following the second half of that statement, therefore, what did I say? We ought to stop the rise in global temperatures. That is not a statement of science. Does that make sense? Right? So we can have statements of science, but the therefore, what I ought to do as a result of the way things are in the world, is not a point for scientific investigation. And science cannot comment on this. And I think it would be really helpful if we all helped the rest of the world to understand this point. That is to say, science has a necessary contribution to our moral thinking because it tells us how things work. It tells us the consequences of the actions we will take. It has an absolutely essential role to play, but itself cannot determine between actions. And I think if we, when we hear scientists trying to make ethical statements, as conclusions of science, I think we need to call their bluff, and we need to say, no, that's not the place of science to do that. I understand you might have an opinion on this, but of course that's fine. But that's not a scientific statement that you're making. And I think if we can remind people of that division between those two things, purpose and nature, we actually can open up the discussion of how to live rightly in the world without being held hostage to the idea that science will give us all these answers, and that we can look to science to tell us how to live rightly in the world. So anyway, that's just one implication. I think it'd be very helpful for whoever, whether you're a Christian believer or not, to recognize these limits and try to remind the public, for the public discussion, that this is the case and this is the limit of science in this particular arena. And then secondly, we've already talked about this, but science must not confuse functionality with purpose. Okay? We cannot continue to confuse functionality with purpose. So, the pen is a good example. But think about in terms of some slightly more to the point or human relevant example than a pen. I mean, there's lots of discussion out there in our ethical discussions about what to do with our reproductive organs, for instance, right? That's a common conversation that takes place in the world. But what does science tell us about it? Well, it can tell us all the different potential functions for our reproductive organs, but it doesn't tell us the purpose for which they were given, right? And so what we cannot simply equate functionality with purpose, or we get into big trouble in our ethical thinking, our moral reason.
Let's see.
And so just a very simple implication, again, of this idea that science has its role to play is that we need scientific research programs to be broad and deep so that we are learning more and more about the world. And I think we get into trouble when we start having we start restricting our scientific research to kind of applied to things that can produce marketable products rather than just doing purely basic research for the heck of it. Right, for the sake of learning something new about the world, because it's only as we learn the simple basic facts about the world that we can contribute to this discussion about moral reasoning. It's not that if we can create a new product for Apple or whoever that we learn new things about the way the world works. That's just not the way it happens. And so we need to think of science as basic research as a very good and helpful thing, an essential thing, if we're going to learn how to live rightly in the world. And again, ethics is a metaphysical pursuit. That is, it is not something we're going to discover from the nature of the world around us. And yet science is an essential component of that. And I'll actually leave the last one off, I think.